Kid Zone.
Today
you can
we
head
are
off at this time up for Kid
to
Zone.
The study of Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. The section in Matthew chapter 5 to 7. Some Bibles I know highlighted in red whenever it's the words of Jesus. Well, the whole section is all the words of Jesus. And it's here where Jesus is teaching us how to understand and apply the Bible's practical moral wisdom and guidance to the core issues of life. In the first four contrasts between the religious leaders, what they were teaching, what they understood righteousness to be, and what Jesus is understanding God's original intention for righteousness to be, we have noticed, hopefully, a natural progression taking place. In each case, Jesus' moral lever has reached to the very heart of the matter, to the depths of God's intent, and to the depths of our problem. And so we looked at the root of murder. What is that? It's an attitude of anger and contempt. That's the source. That's the root. Of adultery, it's lust. Of divorce, we looked at Jesus says, no, don't aim for a divorce. Aim for a great marriage. The root, source, problem of oaths is because there's dishonesty, a lack of integrity. And I remember years ago reading the Zechariah story in Luke chapter 1. And Zechariah, if you know that story at all, him and his wife were desperate for a child, and they had really given up hope. And yet there he was, interceding on behalf of the whole community of faith that God would answer prayer. And the angel of the Lord shows up and says, Zechariah, your prayers have been answered. And he doesn't believe it because he's been disappointed so long. And I remember reading, and there was an aha moment. And the aha moment was, I wonder what his doubt looks like from the angel's perspective. Because Zechariah is thinking, how can I know this is true? And I think the angel is thinking, how could you think it wouldn't be true? Because you think the angel had lived in the presence of God from eternity. How many times had the angel ever seen one of God's promises fail? Never. Couldn't imagine that it wouldn't. And yet we live and we project our own lack of our doubts, our own lack of follow-through on promises onto that. Well, we get taken deeper and deeper by Jesus into God's intent and will because we're getting at what God's character is like. Well, we come to the fifth and sixth contrasts. And here the stakes are raised higher than ever. Before we saw, I called it, you know, Jesus was calling us to radical righteousness. And that word radical also means root, right? Right to the root of it. Well, I think you'll agree with me. He's getting to be very radical now. Let's read first Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42. You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go with him 1 mile, go with them two. Give to the one who asks and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Once again, we have seen the threefold pattern that we have looked at. There's an Old Testament teaching. First, you have heard that it was said, and then there's a quotation in this case. And then there's a contrasting interpretation. Jesus will say, but I tell you, and then he will illustrate it. In this case, he'll give four illustrations. And this one, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, read in context, and it occurs especially in Exodus, three places in the Old Testament, but very similar, Exodus 21. We can see Jesus quoting a basic principle of justice, exact retribution. If there is a serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. We get the idea. It's not unlike our saying the punishment should fit the crime, right? It's the law of retaliation. It was a guiding principle with a double purpose. First, it defined justice. This is what justice looks like. And then it was also intended to restrain retaliation. You see, in popular thought and practice, people took it out of a legal context. That's where it's originally given. Instructions for those whose job it is to make sure that justice is done. And instead, they took it out and said and put it into the realm of personal retribution. That is, well, I'm within my rights to even the score. If someone, you know, especially they do something wrong to me, so they poke me in the eye, I get to poke them back. Now, there's one problem with this, illustrated with a cartoon. Okay, so you see, this case, you know, the little pea shooter, and he spits it at him, ping. So he should just give a ping back, right? Yeah, you know what's coming. Kaboom, right? This is the problem it was intended to address, is that we make sure that we don't just even the score. We make sure that we even the score with a little extra, right? or a lot extra. And this is what escalates and gets into huge problems. This is the kind of problem the law was intended to resolve. You know, Jesus goes even deeper. His words of contrast, "But I tell you," are revolutionary. And now revolutionary in a nonviolent way, as we see. "Do not resist an evil person." I mean, with that, Jesus is breaking new moral ground by once again deepening what his disciples should be aiming at. Not even the score. Don't aim at just trying to get even. In fact, don't retaliate at all. Just a brief look at the word resist. Anthestemi in Greek. What's the lexical, the meaning of it? It occurs about 13 other times in the New Testament. And just two examples to give you a hint of it. In Romans 9, verse 19, it talks about resisting or opposing God's will. That's negative. We don't want to do that, right? But positively, it's used in James 4, verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Don't oppose. So it's also a positive. So what is Jesus getting at here? I think he's getting at, don't oppose an evil person in like manner. That is, don't resist, don't mirror them. And Paul will have words later on. He will say, do not repay evil for evil. And if we look at it in the context, we will look at Jesus himself as defining, what do I mean by do not resist an evil person? Well, let's look at the first one. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek. Now, one of the important things is to know is that this is not abuse. This is not in the area of abuse, but it is a very great insult. And it was the kind of insult that the rabbis talked about that should merit punishment. And as New Testament scholar Walter Wink notes, in fact, a backhanded slap, because if you think about it, if I'm going to slap you on the right cheek, and most of the time people are right-handed. I know, sorry for all of you who are left-handed, but right-handed, okay? So if I get you on the right cheek, what am I going to have to do? Backhand, right? That's the usual way of admonishing inferiors. The only normal response would be to cower in fear. But we need to recall that Jesus' listeners are not those who are normally in the positions of power, not those who strike, initiate lawsuits, or impose forced labor, but they're often victims who are subjected to these very kinds of indignities. So Jesus is talking about, this is the kind of illustration that the crowds that are listening to him would get. This is our language. This is our life. We're not the oppressors. Most of the time, we're those who are in the situation of the oppressed. And I do not think Jesus is commanding victimization. We'll see why. But he is illustrating actually a different kind of power, a power of non-retaliation. Remember, Jesus went before Pilate. Pilate, in John chapter 19, was shocked that Jesus did not retaliate. He thought first it was weakness. Then he discovered that it was a greater inner strength. You see, Jesus modeled this in his passion narrative. Look at Matthew chapter 26. It's exactly the same word, slapped. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us. Who hit Messiah? Who hit you?" You know, and Peter, he'll pick it up and he'll say, yeah, this is the way of Jesus. This is what it looked like. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 23, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. That sense of vengeance, he said, it's not mine. I give that over to God. That's too much power. I wouldn't know how to handle that properly. That's how I understand that. Yet both Jesus and Paul, interestingly, also had occasions where they didn't necessarily mirror evil, but they did resist. They challenged the illegality of actions against them. Just an example in John chapter 18, verses 22 to 23. Again, where they slapped him in the face, but they shouldn't have done that. And he challenges the injustice of that, at least verbally. So I think what he is ruling out, and Paul will actually do the same thing. He will appeal to Caesar in Acts chapter 25. But I think what is being ruled out here and in each occasion is retaliation. See, the law of retaliation, and Jesus says, no, no retaliation at all. Jesus exposed what Walter Wink calls the myth of redemptive violence. We see that in cartoons, right? What happens? Somebody hits somebody, somebody gets somebody back. It's in every, you know, all movies, everything. That's how you make things right. You settle the score. It is a myth, though, of redemptive violence in which violence is often portrayed as the means of redemption for the oppressed. Fight violence with violence. But what Jesus distilled was a way of opposing evil without becoming evil in the process, without becoming what we hate. Becoming nonviolent from the heart, so as not to let the insulter or the persecutor determine our response. Doesn't that take power and strength? God-like power and strength. It's a third way. It's not cowering like a victim, and it's not fighting back in the same manner. It is a new way. Jesus gives another example. If someone wants to sue you, New Living Translation adds, in court. It's right. They're getting, that's the sense, the context here. It seems to envision a person, again, these are all personal illustrations, someone with malicious intent because they're evil. Do not resist an evil person, right? And the result of which could be the loss. You're going to lose your shirt. And Jesus teaches not only that a person free from the need to retaliate can give up what one is sued for, but hey, you could even voluntarily give up your coat as well. Now, no one legally was allowed to take the outer coat because most of these people did not have homes with heating in. They needed it to keep warm at night. And the Old Testament law said, you can only take it during the day, but you got to give it back to the poor person at night. And so you're totally exposed. I think it would also expose how much the person is trying to take. But he's saying, exceed what's demanded. Give more than expected. And Paul, too, will say in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 7, that a follower of Christ should be ready to let him or herself be wronged for a greater good. That should be in your toolbox of options as a follower of Christ when you are released from this need for retaliation. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, angeria is the word in Greek. It's a very distinct word. It has the idea of being pressed into service by military authorities. That's why they're telling you to, because the military, how did they carry things in those days? They had a big heavy pack and they got tired of carrying it. So they could enlist someone, they're walking along the side of the road, a civilian, you carry my pack for a mile. That was totally within their ability to do that, and you were not going to balk at that. But they hated it. The Jews fiercely resented such forced service that just reinforced that they were treated like dirt. As one ancient quote put it, angeria, that's the Greek word, is like death. Jesus, what are we supposed to do when that happens? He says, rather than resisting or even resenting, as disciples, you should try something radically different. Volunteer to do double duty. Now, can you imagine, I was thinking about this, can you imagine you're going to tell your teenager to do a chore that you know they do not like doing? You're already ready for the pushback that you're going to get. And you go and you say, I want you to take out the garbage, and you're just ready to reinforce it with some more arsenal of stuff. And they say, oh, I'd love to. Can I do something else too? It's like going to rock your world. You're going to be like discombobulated for the rest of the day. You're not going to know, like, I wasn't ready for that. Right? Jesus goes on. He's going to apply it now, the fourth illustration. It should be radical even to your possessions. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Give seems totally unqualified. But the parallelism of the sentence. In Greek, and especially Hebrew, there's always a parallelism. One idea is said and it's reinforced or deepened in the second half of the phrase. So give to the one who asks you, and it's kind of repeated, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Get that? So it's helping us understand give, the context that Jesus has in mind. And so it's probably someone in need of assistance. They're asking you for some financial or practical help. And we see this kind of precedent set in Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy 15 verses 7 to 11. It says there, if anyone is poor among you in any of the towns of the land your Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. And then this famous line, there will always be poor in the land. Not because there should be, but because we live in a fallen world. And therefore, because there's always food, therefore I command you to be, what does he say? Open-handed. It's right there. It was always there. He's just drawing it out. Generosity to those in need is actually commanded. It's not just suggested, right? For followers of Jesus, the request itself is the only claim required to move them. They will not evade, ignore, or turn away from those who would borrow from them. These four illustrations are very radical, are they not? But they are not a new set of laws. They are a new set of possibilities. Examples of the kinds of things that Christ's freedom from personal vengeance and tight-fistedness will free us to be and to do. The conduct of the disciples is filled with surprise for those who experience it. Those surprised by grace. Because we've had that moment where we come under the conviction of our sin and we go to God and God surprises us. He says, of course I forgive you. I love you. Now let's work at building my kingdom. Well, we look to the final example, Jesus' sixth example of radical righteousness. a call to love without limits like God. Few of us manage to go through life without collecting a group of individuals who would not be sorry to learn that we had died. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. We call them enemies. And it is those who are at the center of Jesus' final interpretation and illustration of radical righteousness. Especially it would have been key how the Jews were understanding these oppressors, these non-Jewish nations, especially who they felt smited by. And here the old righteousness was pretty simple if you read it, especially love your neighbor. That's a direct quote. The other part, and hate your enemy. Not really any direct quote anywhere. You can read that, you know, because God judged the enemies. And so they took that. That must mean we don't have to love our enemy. You see here, their old righteousness, very simple. Love your neighbor, but not your enemy. Do I have the cartoon? Yes. You see, I've discovered that loving others is a lot easier when you can nuke the ones who don't love you back. So it's just easier to be able to love your neighbor if you just have less people in that neighbor category, right? And that's the story of the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the legal expert in the laws of God, you know, was, well, who is my neighbor? And I want to know who sits outside that. And Jesus is, he extends the definition of neighbor to include enemies and even those who persecute you. Remember at the beginning in the Beatitudes. Enemies are those who seek our destruction, so it would be natural that we seek theirs. Justice. We think that's justice, but Jesus says, no, God is calling you to a higher standard. He tells us to love our enemies and to carry that love through with a very specific way. The highest act of love, pray for your enemy. That is active love, to pray for the good of them, not to pray. Yeah, I'm going to pray that God will take him down. And yeah, not quite, okay? But to pray that God would break into their life, to change their heart, that they could be a brother and sister in Christ. Followers of Jesus are to love their enemies as well as their friends. And why Jesus gives the main illustration? Because just look at God. How does God treat his enemies? He says, oh, I'm going to send some, it's dry, I need to send some rain. I'm just going to send it on the good people and not the bad people. Oh, the sunshine. See, aren't we glad this is, because otherwise we'd feel in Coquitlam sometimes like we're the bad people because everybody else seems to get sunshine and we get the, you know, the clouds. God is indiscriminate in his extravagance of grace to people. He gives grace to people who don't deserve it. All kinds of people, including us. And he says, we should be like God. You know, because there's no reward for just loving those who love us, even the despised tax collectors. Like those were the gangsters, if you will, or the terrorists, or whoever you want to put in that category, that for sure you know those aren't the good people, those are the bad people. And he says, well, even they love their own kind. And even if we show courtesy to our friends, like there's nothing extraordinary. Nobody's going to go like, oh, wow, that was really surprising. No, but it's when you love the others who are on the hit list, that's extraordinary. Be perfect, just like God. That is complete. The word is the sense of complete, wholehearted, we might say. Now, I don't have time to go into just a brief comment. As Mennonite brethren, our congregation is in the stream of Christian history that goes back to the time of the Reformation, the 1500s. We're part of Mennonites. Founder Menno Simons, who had been a Catholic priest, read the Bible. He was challenged by people who were actually living their faith, read the Bible, and was transformed. Even though he'd been a priest, he'd read about the Bible, but never the Bible himself. And one of the things that became under real conviction to them was these words of Jesus, like, these are for us to live. We should really practice loving our enemies. And it meant that they wouldn't take up arms and try to kill others. The root of it is here. Now, if your viewpoint is different from this, I hope you don't hear me saying that I question the seriousness of your Christian faith or the carefulness of your reasoning. I'm not saying that. I just say, I would say that I disagree with you. And I would say because of Jesus' words. And I just want to leave you with a video clip, an illustration of the fellow's name here on the video is Rick. Rick is actually now a pastor. Some of you have been here before. You will have seen a different clip from Rick's life, how he went from a teenager who had nothing to do with God. They would do prank phone calls into those, call 1-800 and you need prayer, you know, and they would nothing to do with God. And then he gives us a window into this kid that he used to pick on, what happened to him when Rick decided to finally try out coming to church.
There was this kid in high school that was sort of, he was kind of an effeminate kid, you know, he just got mocked all the time, and he was always really cool to me, but I was in these crowds where, you know, he'd be over, you know, at lunch, we could talk, let's say, in class or whatever, and I'd be cordial to him. But then at lunch, you know, if all your buddies were kind of mocking a guy, you just sort of stand there and watch, you know, maybe not participate, but not really tell him to shut up kind of a thing. So here's this kid, and he's just sort of this geeky guy that isn't popular, doesn't have a lot of friends, but really nice kid. And yet, he wasn't okay in my world. You know what I mean? He wasn't going to be accepted into my world. And I remember when I walked into a church, he was there. And he completely, like, embraced me into his world, where should have been the last thing he did, you know? I mean, this is his place. This is his friends. This is his world. It's safe. And now I'm coming in with all my baggage and all my stuff. And he didn't once just, like, go, you've been mean to me, or, you know what I mean, like, hold anything against me. Just totally embraced me and received me and was like, that's not you anymore. I remember him saying that, you know, where I apologized. I was like, dude, you know, there were so many times where I should have stuck up for you, or, you know, but I didn't. I just went with the crowd and, like, yeah, maybe let's make fun of the weak guy. And then as soon as I walk into church, this dude's, like, embraced me and, you know, being nice to me and showing me how to read the Bible and, you know, just being cool. And I remember apologizing for that and him going, yeah, that wasn't you. That's not who you are anymore. And I think it just showed up in this, like, well, that's so not how it's supposed to work, you know? It's like he should have held it against me. He should have. And I got forgiven, you know? He got beat up, and I got forgiven. It was just like, wow. And to me, that's someone who's following Jesus, you know? That's what it looks like. It's like, wow, the reason you do that is because you're doing what Christ did, you know? He prays on the cross, forgive them, they don't know what they do. And you prayed that prayer to me while we were throwing stuff at you at lunch, you know? So it was just this powerful picture of, like, when people are really following Jesus, you know? Like, you know it. You know, you can feel it. It looks really different than the rest of the world does.
Would you rather aim for justice? Or would you rather aim at changing the world? Aim for grace. Well, we are come to a time when we are going to celebrate communion together. And that really prefaced it for us. I just want to read a few verses from 1 Peter chapter 2.